So different high-profile marriages have different associations. Richard and Judy, we associate with talk shows. David and Victoria Beckham, we associate with celebrity glamour. Charles and Diana, we associate with tension and unhappiness, and so we could go on. Well, one of the Bible's most high-profile marriages is Ahab and Jezebel. Ahab was a king of Israel, his bride, a Sidonian princess, and I expect that most of us associate this couple with something too, and not a very nice something. We associate Ahab and Jezebel with wickedness, gross and outrageous wickedness, because this husband and wife wreaked havoc in Israel, perpetrating injustice, unleashing violent persecution, flooding the land with moral and religious filth. That was Ahab and Jezebel. Now, why am I talking about them this evening? Well, because there's a section of two kings coming in which we're going to encounter judgment. Decisive, devastating judgment. Judgment from heaven because of this wicked couple. God punishing their wretched deeds. Now, I say it's coming. We're not quite there yet in the passage that we're looking at tonight. We're in, as it were, the calm before the storm. But it's obvious that the judgment is coming. You can smell it. It casts its shadow right across our passage. So much so, indeed, that this divine judgment is going to be the theme of our sermon this evening. And we're going to consider three things in particular. And first of all, then, the pace of its arrival. The pace of its arrival. And in a word, it's slow. This divine judgment resulting from Ahab and Jezebel's depraved antics, it's conspicuously slow. I mean, Ahab is dead. And he hasn't died recently either. His initial successor on Israel's throne was Ahaziah, not the Ahaziah who features in this evening's passage. There are a lot of different people who have the same names in this section of Kings. But rather, it's the Ahaziah that we encountered right at the beginning of this series in 2 Kings, in chapter 1 of the book. That guy who, you remember, injured himself in a fall and sent to a pagan god for a prognosis. Ahaziah succeeded Ahab, and he ruled Israel for 2 years. He was then succeeded by Joram, and you'll notice that our passage, chapter 8, verse 25, refers to the 12th year of Joram. And according to my maths, then, 2 plus 12 equals 14. Ahab has been dead 14 years. That's a long time. To convert it into British politics, 14 years ago, Gordon Brown was our Prime Minister. I mean, who remembers him anymore? It really feels like the dim and distant past, doesn't it? And in the same way, then, in 2 Kings 8, Ahab's reign is in the dim and distant past. And yet still, the divine judgment on Ahab's reign and Jezebel with him, it hasn't transpired. If you're an Israelite in 2 Kings 8 and you think about it at all, you probably think it's not going to transpire. Not now. Not after all this time has gone by. You're going to think that the God who supposedly hates the kind of stuff that Ahab and Jezebel did is just turning a blind eye and doing nought about it. And for some Israelites, that conclusion is going to bring with it great pain and disillusionment. For one family, at least, it is a family that lives in the Israelite town of Jezreel, Naboth's family. 14 years with no divine judgment is going to bring them pain, because it means that the scandalous dispossession of Naboth's vineyard and the brutal execution of Naboth himself have gone unpunished. And 14 years with no divine judgment are going to bring them disillusionment as well. Because after the Naboth atrocity, you may remember, God had expressly promised that judgment would be forthcoming. You can read his words delivered through Elijah in 1 Kings 21, verses 21 to 23. And it seems then that he has failed to fulfill that pledge. I'm saying God's judgment on Ahab and Jezebel is really slow, and I'm saying it isn't an emotionally inconsequential slowness. I only put our Christmas things back in the attic a couple of weeks ago, the middle of March, almost a quarter of the way through 2022, but who cares? It's no big deal. It's an emotionally inconsequential slowness. This is not. Not for those in Israel whose lives were ruined by Ahab and Jezebel's evil. As month follows month and year follows year, and there's no sign of any divine vengeance. It's not like a couple of boxes of festive decorations still on the landing in springtime. For those people, it's emotionally very consequential indeed. It's gutting. It's heart-wrenching. It's soul-destroying. And there are many Christians in our world today who know that feeling. Christians who are familiar with their Bibles, who know that the judgment God promised in relation to Ahab and Jezebel, he has promised in relation to all Ahabs and Jezebels. That there's supposed to be a day coming when wickedness and evil will properly and comprehensively receive its just deserts. And yet there those Christians are in Afghanistan. And the Taliban are still getting away with their intimidation and oppression. There those Christians are in North Korea. And the totalitarian regime is still getting away with its torture and barbarity. There those Christians are in northern Nigeria. And the terrorist groups are still getting away with their attacks and massacres. What's going on, those believers in Jesus Christ? Where is the promised judgment? Why is it so slow? I'm not a believer in Afghanistan or North Korea or northern Nigeria, but I find myself all the same often praying Psalm 7, verse 9. O righteous God who searches minds and hearts, bring to an end the violence of the wicked and make the righteous secure. It's a prayer for the end, for the terminating of wickedness on Judgment Day and the securing of the righteous in the new world itself. The prayer forms in my heart partly as I read the world news pages there in Evangelicals Now and discover what's going on in those countries. Partly as I survey the anti-Christian forces currently sweeping through Western societies and the aggressiveness with which they want to rip up every remaining biblical influence on our culture and overturn every norm deriving from the Judeo-Christian worldview. O righteous God who searches minds and hearts, bring to an end the violence of the wicked and make the righteous secure. And it's now the 3rd of April, 2022. And the violence of the wicked hasn't been brought to an end. And the righteous haven't been made secure. God's repeatedly promised, long-awaited judgment still remains to be seen. It's slow. It's slow. What then are we to say about that? Well, two things quickly. First of all, God is patient. God is patient. Even when it's Ahab and Jezebel, judgment does not come naturally and easily to God. I mean, he announces an initial delay of the judgment on Ahab and Jezebel almost as soon as he has announced the judgment itself. Do you remember that back in 1 Kings in chapter 21? And there you've had the whole Naboth's vineyard incident, and Yahweh then in his anger sends Elijah the prophet to Ahab, and he delivers that announcement of judgment, especially in verses 21 to 23, I will bring disaster upon you, I will utterly burn you up, and will cut off Ahab every and will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free in Israel. I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, and so on. It's very similar language to what we have in our passage. But then you come to verse 25 of that chapter. And we read, there was none who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord, like Ahab, whom Jezebel his wife incited. He acted very abominably in going after idols, as the Amorites had done, whom the Lord cast out before the people of Israel. And so you think, well, yes, definitely then this judgment is about to fall, as God has just announced. And then verse 27, when Ahab heard those words, he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his flesh, and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went about dejectedly. And suddenly there's this U-turn in God's approach. The word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the disaster in his days, but in his son's days I will bring the disaster upon his house. And as a reader, you almost want to say, God, come on, don't be fooled by this show of repentance from Ahab. This wily old king is taking advantage of you, Lord. He's just putting on a facade. And God, of course, knows that better than anybody does. Psalm 7, verse 9 again. A righteous God who searches hearts and minds. He searches the mind and heart of Ahab. He knows the superficiality, the inauthenticity of that repentance. And yet, any slightest pretext for deferring judgment, and God kind of seizes on it. I won't do it now, I'll do it in the days of your son Ahab. Which means then that surely judgment has to fall during the reign of Ahaziah, Ahab's son. Except that something extraordinary happens. Ahaziah dies childless, so that he's replaced by who? Well, another son of Ahab, Joram. Which means that judgment can be further delayed, still within the parameters of 1 Kings 21 there. And you can't help feeling that Ahaziah's childlessness is really just a bit of divine manoeuvring to delay judgment a bit further. In professional football, when teams are winning matches, they often have these very kind of clever delaying tactics to give the opposition less chance of getting back into the game. There was a notorious one just a few months ago, I think it was back in December, Arsenal were beating West Ham, and at one point an Arsenal player fell onto the ground. He was injured, but he fell onto the ground just to the side of the pitch, just over the white line, meaning that the referee then wouldn't be bound to stop the game, of course, to get the player treated because he wasn't technically on the pitch. And the Arsenal manager was furious about this. And an opportunity here was being squandered to slow the game down, stop the game for a few minutes and waste a bit of time. And so what the Arsenal manager did was he went over to the player and dragged him onto the pitch just so that the referee would then have to stop the game, get the physio on, and that would waste some time. Even by modern footballing standards, it was a pretty brazen delaying tactic. And God's delaying tactic, then, is quite something here. He has promised that judgment will be during the reign of Ahab's son, and so he just tampers with the way that royal succession normally works in Israel and replaces one son of Ahab with another son of Ahab. But in this case, then, it isn't because God is a cheat, like those scheming football managers. It's because he's stunningly patient. He's stunningly patient. Isn't that what the Apostle Peter says? 2 Peter 3 verse 9, the Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness. It seems like he is, Peter's acknowledging. No, but he is patient towards you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. God is patient. And then the other thing to say here is that judgment does come. Judgment does come. It might have taken 14 long years, but it came in the end. That's what we're going to see in the next section of 2 Kings that we'll come to next time. And in its fullest sense then, in the Psalm 7 verse 9 sense, God's judgment will come. It will come. And every Naboth, every Christian Naboth in Afghanistan and in North Korea and in northern Nigeria and everywhere else, every Christian Naboth will receive justice in the end. The ungodly will not triumph forever. Heaven will not always remain unresponsive in the face of wickedness. That great day when wrongs are to be righted will dawn. Judgment does come. There's a beautiful balancing here then of God's different traits and tendencies. On the one hand, he holds off his judgment to an extent that makes us fall down in worship before God's extraordinary patience. That's what we noted just now. But on the other hand, he refuses to hold off his judgment endlessly. Patience doesn't morph into shrugging indifference with God. The delay finally makes way for vengeance, so that in the end we must bow in worship before his rigorous justice as well. What a God we have. Magnificently patient and awesomely just. Not one or the other, but both of these things, both of them beautifully balanced within the hearts of our God. So we're looking at God's judgment then in relation to Ahab and Jezebel, and we've considered first of all the pace of its arrival, but then notice secondly this evening the importance of its decontamination, the importance of its decontamination. So divine judgment serves various purposes. For one thing, it satisfies that justice that's so deeply ingrained within the character of God. We've seen that God can and does hold off his judgment for a long time, but if one single wrong done by someone at some point in history, if one single wrong from the whole of world history were to go everlastingly unpunished, then that would cause God's very being to unravel. It would undo him. His justice must ultimately be satisfied. Then for another thing, divine judgment, it also serves to some extent to compensate and console victims of wickedness and those associated with them. That's why, as we said, its slowness here would have been so painful for Naboth's family. They needed the closure that God's judgment would bring. So those are two purposes which God's judgment serves. But then there's another. You see, it's in the nature of wickedness to spread. We encounter that principle often, don't we, in the Bible? It's why the Bible likens wickedness to leaven, to yeast. It's this propensity that wickedness has to spread. Yeast was well known for, and is well known for, its gradual but inexorable expansion and gaining of ground, millimetre by millimetre, centimetre by centimetre. And wickedness then is like that. And we see that feature of wickedness here in our passage. Ahab and Jezebel's wickedness spreads. We have this phrase, this refrain in our passage, as the house of Ahab had done. As the house of Ahab had done. And that phrase then, it travels scarily. So in chapter 8, verses 16 and 17, we are reading there about Judah's monarchy. This is a shift in the book, actually. We've been in Israel, in the northern kingdom, the whole time, in Two Kings, and we've been viewing the monarchy there. But now in chapter 8, verses 16 and 17, there's this sudden shift of attention from Israel's monarchy to Judah's monarchy. And you kind of think, that'll be good. That'll be a nice, refreshing break for us as readers. We're going to be miles away now from toxic Samaria, and we're going to be in healthy Jerusalem, where there have been two pretty decent kings on the trot, Asa and Jehoshaphat, and this now is going to be pleasant reading. And then you come to verse 18. it's telling us about this next king of Judah after Jehoshaphat, his son Jehoram, who confusingly is also called Joram in the same passage. And we read in verse 18, and he, that's this king of Judah, following godly Asa, following fairly godly Jehoshaphat, and he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as the house of Ahab had done. For the daughter of Ahab was his wife, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And there's this spread then. And as the house of Ahab had done, has travelled to the southern kingdom, to Jerusalem, and it's infected and contaminated things there. Ah, well, you say, surely that will just be a blip. Things will get back on course, no doubt, with the next king, Ahaziah, the next king of Judah. He'll be different. But then you come to verse 26. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 1 year in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Athaliah. She was a granddaughter of Omri, king of Israel. He also walked in the way of the house of Ahab and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, as the house of Ahab had done. The same refrain again, for he was son-in-law to the house of Ahab. As the house of Ahab had done, has travelled now not only to the southern kingdom, but to a second generation of monarchy within the southern kingdom. It's just this seeping, ever-seeping contamination. By the way, Ahaziah, he looks almost bewitched, doesn't he, in this passage. The house of Ahab has such a grip, such an influence on him. I mean, his predecessor on Judah's throne, Jehoram or Joram, he has experienced two great calamities. They're recorded there in verses 20 to 22. Calamity number one, he has lost a vassal state. Edom was a vassal state of Judah's, having to be under Judah's ultimate oversight and control, having to pay tribute to Judah, a valuable thing for Judah to have, a valuable arrangement for Judah to have. But he's lost Edom. Edom has revolted. And he tries to regain Edom, it seems, in verse 21. It's a little bit confusing to work out what's going on there, but it seems that he tries to regain militarily Edom, but there's this rather humiliating upshot to that when he has to, he's presumably besieged by the Edomites himself and has to kind of fight through their lines in order to escape and flee home with his army. So that's calamity number one that Ahaziah's predecessor has suffered. He's lost a vassal state, Edom, but then he's more than that, worse than that. He's even lost one of his own cities. Extraordinary, verse 22. It's just told in passing, but then Libna revolted at the same time. This is a Judean city. And it's split from the kingdom of Judah. It's gone independent. It's turned away from the Judean monarchy. And so these are major, major calamities. And Ahaziah then, the next king of Judah, should have been devoting all his energy and all his efforts and all his resources to reversing his predecessor's calamities. And instead, what's he doing in verse 28? He went with Joram, the son of Ahab, to make war against Hazael, king of Syria, at Ramoth-Gilead. He's gone with the king of Israel to this stupid battle in Ramoth-Gilead. It is a stupid battle. This was Ahab's undoing. How did Ahab die? He died trying to win Ramoth-Gilead back from the Syrians. Do you remember there's that whole incident with the 400 false prophets? And they kept telling Ahab, yes, go and fight at Ramoth-Gilead. You'll win. You'll get the city back. You'll defeat the Syrians. There was one godly prophet, Micaiah. And he said, you won't come back alive. And Ahab listened to the 400 instead of to Micaiah. And he died in that battle. And here now, another Israelite king is just repeating Ahab's mistake, trying to get Ramoth-Gilead. And a king of Judah then, when he has enough problems on his own plate, is kind of bewitched by the house of Ahab. The tentacles of the house of Ahab are so wrapped around him that he just robotically follows the king of Israel into this silly campaign when he should be sorting out things on the home front. And it's the insidious leavening then of Judah's monarchy by the house of Ahab. And this disease, it needs to be halted in its tracks. There needs to be a decontamination and God's judgment on the house of Ahab. In addition to those other things I've already mentioned, yes, it will satisfy God's justice. Yes, it will bring consolation to the family of Naboth and other victims of Ahab and Jezebel. But in addition to all of that, it will also serve this purpose. It will halt the infection, halt the contamination, halt the gangrene, halt the spread of Ahabite wickedness. As the house of Ahab had done, won't travel any further once the house of Ahab has been ground into the dust. That'll be the end of the track. That'll be the end of the road for the wickedness of the house of Ahab. And God's judgment in its fullest sense at the end, it will also serve this purpose. Yes, it will satisfy God's justice. More than any other act of judgment has ever done, the final judgment will satisfy that impulse for justice in the heart of God. Yes, it will bring great consolation to all who have suffered wickedness in this world. But God's judgment on the last day, it will also be a decontaminating thing. That's why it must be so rigorous. So that Revelation 21 verse 27 can come true. Do you remember Revelation 21, that description of the church in its final state, the New Jerusalem? And there's that line at the end there, in verse 27 of that chapter, nothing unclean will ever enter it. In all those eternal ages, nothing unclean will ever again disrupt and interfere with the people of God. Nothing unclean will ever mar the new world, the new creation. Why? Because God will have brought his judgment down on wickedness and will have done so rigorously. There won't be a single spore of wickedness that floats into the world to come. Not a single spore. That's why you have that imagery in 2 Peter 3 of the world being burned up. I don't think that's literal language. It doesn't really square with Paul's description of what's going to happen when Jesus comes in Romans 8, and he says the creation is going to be liberated. It's not going to be burned up. It's going to be set free from its bondage to corruption. There's not going to be a literal conflagration, a literal fire, a literal burning up of the cosmos. But it's Peter's way of saying that there's going to be this complete purgation, this complete catharsis, this complete cleansing. The sweeping away of all evil and all wickedness, so that there can be, as he puts it in that chapter, a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness definitely does dwell and definitely will always dwell without being slowly eroded by some bit of evil that has managed to find its way in from this old age. No evil will find its way in. Isn't that a wonderful prospect? That in that world to come, there will be no pride. There will be no lust. There will be no idolatry. Not in us. Not in anybody else. Not in any structure, any organization. Not in anything or anyone in that world to come. Sin will become almost a forgotten word. This distant memory from an old age. There will be no more sin because the decontaminating effect of God's judgment will make sure of that. All swept away. So there's a brand new, pristine cosmos where nothing unclean can defile. What a wonderful thought, look forward to that. No trace of Ahab. No trace of Satan. No trace of evil at all. Because this world will have gone through the deep clean of God's final judgment. So God's judgment then. On Ahab and Jezebel, we've talked about the pace of its arrival, the importance of its decontamination, and then thirdly and finally, the means of its execution. The means of its execution. And the means then is, of course, this fascinating character, Jehu, whom we encounter there in chapter 9. And so we read then God's message to him through this young prophet sent by Elisha. God's message there in verse 6 of chapter 9. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I anoint you king. Verse 7, and you shall strike down the house of Ahab, your master. And so it goes on. So this divinely anointed king, Jehu, he is going to be the means of the judgment's execution. And in many ways, Jehu will do a good job as the means of the execution of this judgment. But of course, he's only the means of execution in this one-off episode of divine judgment. And Jehu will rise to prominence briefly in order to fulfill this role, and then, of course, he will disappear. And he performs this role in this one chapter of history, this one-off episode, nothing more than that. Which is why, then, we get a glimpse in this passage of another kingship. You can almost miss it. It's back in chapter 8, verse 19. That fascinating remark, the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah, even though it's been contaminated, as we've seen, for the sake of David, his servant, since he promised to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. So David's sons are going to be on the throne forever. And you think, really, forever? Well, yes, forever. Because eventually then there will be a son of David who will take up an eternal rule. And that son of David is, of course, King Jesus. And King Jesus then will be the ultimate means of execution when it comes to the judgment of God. Not King Jehu. King Jehu in this one-off episode. But ultimately, that full divine judgment that I've kept bringing you back to this evening, that divine judgment that is coming at the end, the means of execution will be King Jesus. We perhaps don't think of King Jesus like that. The gentle Jesus, meek and mild, yes, but the New Testament is also very clear. King Jesus will be the means of the execution of God's final judgment. And in fact, I think Jehu, I don't think it's far-fetched and fanciful and contrived to see Jehu as a type of Jesus in a limited respect. I think we're meant to see that. Just a few details. There's the fact that there at the end of our passage in verse 13, we have, don't we, Jehu's colleagues there in Israel's military. We have them immediately recognizing that Jehu has indeed been anointed king, even though, of course, he's not of the royal family. And we read, then in haste, every man of them took his garment and put it under him on the bare steps. And they blew the trumpet and proclaimed Jehu is king. There's only one other occasion in the whole Bible when garments are taken off and put down as a path for a king. And that other occasion, of course, is recorded by Luke in Luke 19, verse 36. It's the entry of Jesus on the donkey into Jerusalem. We have language later on in the Jehu story. In chapter 10, verse 16, we have the language of zeal. Jehu says in chapter 10, verse 16, come with me and see my zeal for the Lord. Well, that's language, isn't it, that will be used of King Jesus. Zeal for the Lord Almighty has consumed me. And then there's the fascinating way in which Jehu, in executing divine judgment, will conquer Jezebel. That's toward the end of chapter 9. and will conquer Jezebel, intriguingly, in her kind of capacity as a prostitute. She comes out on that day, her eyes painted and her head adorned. And I'm not saying she looks like a prostitute there because I'm having attack on cosmetics, but because that is, in biblical terms, the kind of language that elsewhere is used of a prostitute. In Ezekiel 16 it is. This painting of the eyes. And of course, King Jesus. We haven't got time to go there this evening, but King Jesus in Revelation 17. King Jesus is depicted as conquering the prostitute, Babylon. And there are other similarities, interestingly, the same way that some of Jezebel's own servants will turn against her. And in Revelation 17, you have some of Babylon's own kind of turning against the prostitute. And there are these similarities then. Jehu, in a limited way, a type of Jesus. But it is in a limited way. And here is one major difference. Jehu, in his executing of divine judgment, he's a bit of a madman. He's a bit of a reckless, wild, unrestrained madman. That's why you have that material in Hosea. Robert was talking about it a few weeks ago when preaching on Hosea chapter 1. And you have Jehu mentioned in Hosea 1 in negative terms. Hosea 1 verse 4. In a little while, God says, I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. And you think, well, Jehu was given the role of shedding blood, was he not? Executing divine judgment, yes, but he went further than he should have done. There was an unrestrainedness, a wildness, a recklessness about Jehu. I think chapter 9, verse 20, that quite famous verse about Jehu, it kind of sums him up. You remember how you have that watchman who sees Jehu riding in his chariot, and he says the driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he drives furiously. And that sums up this man. There's a fury about him. And it's out of control. And it goes too far, and it's excessive, and it spills over where it shouldn't spill over. That, I think, is the reason for this strange business of the servant of the prophet having to get out of the place so quickly. Elisha says, don't linger, anoint him, and then run. Why? Because he's a scary man, Jehu. You don't want to stay around him too much. Not once he's got a crown on his head and he's starting to think in kingly terms. Just get away from the scene. And King Jesus then is so different, isn't he? King Jesus is so different. With his wrath, with his execution of judgment, which is real. It's real. There's not an absence of control. There's not a wildness where it could spill over in any possible way. Jesus is careful in the execution of divine judgment. He's careful that no one who shouldn't experience it will experience it. In fact, he's so careful about that that, of course, he himself doesn't just execute divine judgment, he also suffers it. And that's one huge difference with Jehu. Jehu has his triumphal entry there in chapter 9, verse 13. He has the coat spread before him, and then he goes immediately to conquering the prostitute Jezebel with Jesus. There's a huge chronological gap in between. He goes into Jerusalem, and the garments are put down before him, and he doesn't then go into executing judgment mode. He goes into suffering judgment mode, and he hangs on a cross to make sure that the wrath will only fall on those unrepentant enemies and will not fall on a single believer, a single soul who has entrusted him or herself to him. And isn't that a marvelous thing? Do you sometimes perhaps worry about the great day of judgment? I've talked about it today in positive terms. I think as Christians we should think of it largely in positive terms, as the end of evil and the end of wickedness and the triumph of God. But perhaps sometimes you're a bit fearful. What if this day of wrath, as Paul calls it, what if some of that wrath ends up kind of inflicting collateral damage, and it spills over to me, even though I'm a believer in Jesus Christ. It won't. It won't. Because the wrath inflictor on that day will be the wrath-bearing Lamb, Jesus, the Lamb who conquers the prostitute. And he has borne your wrath, and none of it can spill over to you. And that day will be safe for you. It won't be safe for his enemies, but it will be safe for you if you're a believer. And nobody who shouldn't receive the wrath of God because they've entrusted themselves to Jesus will receive the wrath of God. He's no Jehu in the last analysis. He's our wrath-bearing Lamb, King Jesus. Cling confidently to him. Amen.